Thank you very much. That was actually already a very nice summary of my talk. So I think most people who know me because of this thingy here, functional renormalization group. So for that reason, I also decided to talk about this here. But I will promise you that the talk will not only be methodological, but I will also show some nice applications. All right, so this is the scope, the overall scope of this method. So we are treating these types of two-body spin Hamiltonians. As usual, I and J are some latticides. J are some exchange constants. In total, we can treat 2D and 3D lattices. We are also quite flexible concerning frustrated interactions, longer range interactions. Also, unlike shown here, we also can consider anisotropic interactions, as shown here, and also off-diagonal anisotropies. And we are actually also not restricted to spin 1/2, even though most of the talk will be about spin 1/2 systems, but we can also increase the spins. Now I should, of course, be very careful when listing it like this, because it might easily one might easily get the impression that we can do everything. That's, of course, not true. Therefore, this star here, terms and conditions apply. I will also talk about the limitations of this method, but they are actually relatively few. Of course, there are also other very powerful numerical methods to treat such systems, but this talk is about the functional renormalization group method, and actually about a special variant of the functional renormalization group method, which is called the pseudofermion FRG. And then, okay, I guess it's needless to say here that with these types of Hamiltonians, one can investigate really a huge variety of interesting phenomena and phases. The quantum spin liquid, which many of us likes a lot, is just one interesting phase. Interesting spin textures, skirmion phases. These phases have topological properties sometimes, like fractional quasi-particles. And also, there are many interesting material realizations around. For example, a quantum spin liquid has been proposed to be realized in this Herbert Smithite compound. Okay, so this brings me to the plan of this talk. The first part will be a bit method-oriented, so I will introduce the two basic ingredients which I need for this approach. These are pseudofermions and the functional renormalization group. Then I show applications of this method. First of all, some benchmark checks for the 2D Kagome lattice. And then in the next step, I also show you an application to a real-world material. This is this calcium chrome oxide compound, and I hope I can convince you that this is quite an interesting spin liquid candidate system. I will briefly say something about extensions and outlook, and then I will conclude. Okay, so let's start with pseudofermions. Our method actually does not directly work on the basis of spin operators, but instead expresses the spin operators in terms of pseudofermions, as shown here. Yeah, this is the usual pseudofermionic representation for spin operators, where on each side we have two fermionic modes, which we call F up and F down. Sigma are the Pauli matrices, and well, this is a valid representation for the spin. However, right at the beginning, it comes along with a problem which needs to be solved, namely that it enlarges the Hilbert space. For each lattice side, the basis set of states in terms of these occupation numbers clearly comprises these four states, while in the spin 1/2 case, we only have two spin states. So there is a clear mismatch in dimensionality. However, it's also easy to show that exactly these two states, which are singly occupied, they correspond to the physical spin 1/2 states, while these none or doubly occupied states, they are unphysical. They actually carry spin zero. So we don't want them to contribute to our results. So we have to make sure that this type of auxiliary particle constraint is fulfilled. Well, it's actually rather non-trivial to fulfill this constraint in general. There are many methods to do that, and this would probably be the topic of a talk on its own, but here I would like to make it rather brief and just briefly mention the most simple, the most convenient way to enforce the constraint. This is just by adding level repulsion terms. These terms are just the squares of the local spin operators. With these eigenvalues here, in the unphysical space, the spin is zero, so this term won't do anything. For the physical subspace, if we choose this prefactor minus a negative, we can push them down in energy. So we can push them down far enough to make sure that the ground state is only made up of physical states. Then we are on the safe side. Okay, with this, the rest just amounts to plugging in the fermionic representation into our Hamiltonian, and we end up with this Hamiltonian, which is now purely quartic in the fermions, so no quadratic term. So this obviously looks pretty awkward. So one may wonder, what have we actually gained here? Well, we now have a fermionic model, which implies that we can do diagrammatics in the fermions, Feynman diagrammatics. So we can define a free fermionic propagator, G naught. In Matsubara space, this is just 1 over I omega, and we draw it as a line with an arrow. Likewise, we have an interaction vertex, which is proportional to J. Now, these two things are basically the building blocks to construct all types of complicated diagrams. Now, the important property is that magnetic susceptibilities, spin-spin correlations, or magnetic response functions, they are proportional to these two particle scattering amplitudes. So here's an example. We have two initial particles. Then they scatter off each other, in this case twice, and they go away. This is, of course, only an example, and if we want to approximate the response better, we have to add more terms, more complicated ones, even more complicated ones, and so on. These are, of course, just examples here. Here I would like to illustrate that in the end, it boils down to a sampling problem of Feynman diagrams, but actually quite a tricky sampling problem.
May I ask a conceptual question? So if you go one step back, in your pseudo-fermion notation, right, the difficulty is that usually what's swept under the rug is the U1 gauge field, which is present in the original Hamiltonian. And so solving the problem of the fermions by themselves, even interacting, myself has been pointed out years back that that's not actually equivalent to solving the original spin problem. So specifically, if you want to do it, you need to also take into account the stronger rotating gauge fields. Now, you could try it into level, argue, well, maybe somehow they freeze out, that's not important. In practice, that only happens in very specific models. For instance, KI model is an example where purpose you freeze out the fluctuations of the shape. But say in two dimensions, if you want to do it generally, you're facing the problem of QED3, and that's still not solved to this day. So what is the hope of doing what you're doing here you know, could it be that we are storing the baby with the bath water by ignoring those fluctuations? Mm.
Well, first of all, I've not yet said anything about gauge fluctuations or about gauge fields at all. So this is simply a representation of the original Hamiltonian, which simply doesn't include any gauge fields. Yeah. One can, of course, later think about how to interpret the approach that we are doing in terms of gauge fields. And we are going into that direction. Yeah, we try to interpret terms, diagrammatic terms, in terms of what are they doing when we think of a gauge theory of the system. But at this point, it's simply a rewriting of the original spin Hamiltonian, which is valid. As long as you take care of the constraint, it's a valid way of rewriting it. So at this point, we don't want to construct an effective theory around the model, which would then naturally boil down to some gauge theory. Yeah, so this is from a very basic level where we start. We don't want to assume something. So we don't want to assume any gauge structure or anything like that. We start from the really bare physics.
So I think Andre's question is really motivated by parts on constructions where constraints get enforced on average. Now you're enforcing your constraint with this level repulsion scheme, and that's site by site, right?
Yeah.
Sort of. There's only one coefficient A, so you know it's an
average. Ah, no. So, well, I mean,
that's just one Lagrange multiplier averaged over all sites.
That shouldn't be confused with the Lagrange multipliers in a typical parton construction. So a typical Lagrange multiplier in a parton construction makes sure that the average is that the constraint is fulfilled on average. This does something different. Yeah, this really physically pushes down the physical subspace in energy. So this is not a Lagrange multiplier. I think that's an important fact here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we have to somehow sum up large diagram classes. But this is still a very difficult problem because we don't have any small parameter in our Hamiltonian. We only have J. That's the only energy scale. So it doesn't make much sense to sum up diagrammatic contribution, let's say, up to fifth order by hand. That would be very uncontrolled. But instead, we always have to self-consistently sum up infinite order diagrammatic contributions. And this is something where it is known that the FRG is very good at. Even with this method, it's still rather non-trivial because you have to make sure that you sum up the right diagrams. But I will come to that. Okay, so this brings me to the functional renormalization group method, unless there are questions about the first part, which doesn't seem to be the case. Okay, so very briefly, what is this method effectively doing? It introduces an infrared frequency cutoff in the propagator. Yes, please.
On your previous thing, so how this coefficient A is chosen, depending on the pattern?
Okay, that's a very good question. In most systems which we are investigating, so in general it's chosen in a way such that you increase it, and if you realize that the results do not change anymore, then you can assume that that your ground state only consists of physical states. These unphysical states that can also be seen, they reduce the susceptibility, the response of the system, because they are simply non-magnetic. In most of the systems which we study, actually A equals zero is already sufficient. Yeah, you can check it. You turn on this A parameter and basically nothing changes. And that property can actually also be understood by the property of the unphysical states. So assume that your ground state would contribute these unphysical states. Then they would carry spin zero. So an unphysical state in the system would effectively correspond to a defect sign. It would correspond to taking out a spin. But taking out a spin, that typically costs energy. Yeah, you have to overcome the couplings of one spins to the surrounding spins. There are counterexamples. There are examples where you place one spin in a strongly fluctuating, in a strongly frustrated environment, where you might gain energy by removing one spin. Then you need a finite value of A, but for most of the systems we are studying, actually A equals zero is efficient.
If A equals zero, then you're not projecting that logic on zero.
I'm not projecting at all, but again, due to energetic arguments, it's often the case that that even without any projection, the ground state simply doesn't like these unphysical states. Yeah, they cost a finite energy.
Take Hubbard model given at large value Q, the double occupancy is never zero.
Oh, I'm not talking about Hubbard model, about Hufeld model. Oh, of course, if at Hubbard models, it's different.
How's it different? I mean, you generally have interacting neutron V. Of course, it's, you know, site dependent, complicated. I'm just asking you to make a simple approximation on site repulsion only. Right? I understand it's a bit dumb, but at least the Hubbard model has been well studied in that way. Would you not agree that not projecting out double occupancy
is bad? I think he doesn't have the Hopping term in the Hamiltonian, right? The Hopping term kind of wants charge fluctuations, and the U term doesn't want charge fluctuations. Here, that's only the kind of rewritten spin term, which doesn't want charge fluctuations.
Right, yeah. We have the charge fluctuations completely frozen out in these models. Yeah. This was also, first of all, surprising to us that just not treating the constraint in many models, I'm not saying in all models, is already sufficient.
In principle, that's something that you could check in your own calculation. You could compute double occupancy on per site and ask what that is. It's identically zero, independently.
Well, we don't have access to the to the real quantity double occupancy because we are calculating these correlation functions, but in principle how we check it is exactly by that A parameter. If the results don't change, if we switch on A, then we are on the safe side. Or there is, yeah, give me a second, there is actually also another method to perform the projection. This is the so-called Popov-Fedotov method, where you introduce an imaginary chemical potential, and with that you can also actually exactly project out unphysical states. We have also tried that, and basically with the exact projection and with the average projection, so means A equals zero in that case, we actually get nearly identical results. So from our point of view, I think we can really say concerning the constraint, we are on the safe side. Yeah. So all problems which arise in our approach do not have to do with the constraint. I think concerning constraint, everything should be fine.
So is it fair to say that your Hamiltonian conserves all of these charge sectors and that the RG flows to the lowest energy bit, and as long as the lowest energy bit is effectively single occupancy per site, everything's okay?
Well, the Hamiltonian conserves the charge anyway. So when you apply spin operators to any state in the physical sector, you will never go in the unphysical one. So these are distinct sectors of the Hamiltonian. Yeah. So, okay, FRT, what are we doing there? We introduce an infrared frequency cutoff, first of all, in the propagator by replacing the Beer-Greens function by a new one, which now carries a theta function in the numerator. This theta function essentially cuts out an energy window on the frequency axis between minus lambda and plus lambda. So lambda is an artificial RG parameter here. So then it's clear, of course, that the whole theory immediately becomes becomes lambda dependent, like the self energy, the two particle vertex. This is basically the magnetic response we are interested in. Three particle scattering amplitudes, and so on. So one may ask the straightforward question, are there some differential equations telling us how these quantities change as a function of lambda? Well, and these equations exist, and these are just the central FRG flow equations. I write them down here in diagrammatic form because they would be too lengthy in explicit form. I don't want to go into detail here, but just show you the overall structure of terms. So the derivative of the self-energy couples to itself via fully renormalized propagators and to the two-particle vertex. The flow of the two-particle vertex, again, couples to the self-energy, to the two-particle vertex in a couple of terms, in all these terms, and to the three-particle vertex. Then the flow of the three-particle vertex, again, couples to lower vertices and to higher vertices. So in this way, one obtains an infinite hierarchy of coupled differential equations, which is, first of all, exact. Yeah, so I find this somehow remarkable, that you can really reformulate the original problem in terms of an exact set of differential equations, which, of course, in this infinite form cannot be treated numerically. So we have to make approximations. And what we usually do is we throw away the three-particle vertex. Then it, of course, becomes approximative. And one can already somehow see what we throw away. The three-particle vertex is an object to describe expectation values of three spin operators. So, for example, chiral spin liquids are hard to describe when we throw away this term. I will tell you in a moment a bit more about what this approximation actually means. But for the moment, we have a closed set of coupled differential equations, which we can solve. So the initial conditions are defined in the limit where lambda is infinitely large. Then the fermionic propagation is completely suppressed, and only the bare two-particle vertex remains. Then we integrate out lambda modes until we reach lambda equals zero. Then we have removed this artificial parameter from the theory. And the physical observable, which we calculate, is the magnetic susceptibility, also as a function of lambda and in momentum space. Now, on this slide, or on the next two slides, I would like to motivate a bit further which diagrammatic contributions we actually sum up, what their meaning is, and what this approximation means. So here I show again the RG equation for the two-particle vertex, where all these terms correspond, or all these terms sum up different diagrams.
Presumably you're going to ask what the gray lines mean, certain integration for certain moment.
Ah, yeah, thanks for the question. The gray line are a derivative. Yeah, you have a derivative on the left side, so that implies you also need to have somewhere a derivative on the right-hand side, and this is a derivative of the propagators, a derivative of the product of these two propagators in there. Yeah, you basically take the derivative of the theta function, which you introduce, and then you get a delta function out of it. Okay, so what what do these different terms mean? So this first term, just taken alone, sums up the ladder diagram exactly and in infinite order. Equivalently, the second term sums up also a ladder diagram, but with opposite directions of the legs. This term sums up the bubble chain, the RPA diagrams, and these are vertex corrections. Now, very broadly speaking, these diagrammatic contributions, they are responsible to different physical effects. So these ladder diagrams, they tend to induce a strong binding between neighboring spins. So in a very simple picture, you can think of that these terms generate singlet pairing in the system, which is needed to describe, for example, dimerized RVD phases and also spin liquids. On the other hand, these terms, they do something very different. Yeah, they can really become long range, they can fluctuate throughout the lattice, so they can describe long range magnetic order. And then the overall idea is to have, so to say, both contributions in there. We can study the competition between, on the one hand, magnetically ordered states and fluctuating states, RVB dimerized states.
Question. Yeah. Are those dashed lines like addressed by the fermions, or they are still a bare level?
These dashed lines here. They are just the bare interactions, the bare chain.
I saw if you sum up all the, if you solve it self-consistently, will you like dress the dashed line?
The dashed line will not be dressed, but the propagators, they will be dressed. They acquire a self-energy. Yeah, you can think of this. The first equation calculates the self-energy, and the propagators in the second equation, they are addressed by this self-energy. The dashed lines are not the objects which get stressed. These things here, these are the objects which get stressed. So this is a stressed version of this here. Okay, yeah, so different physical phenomena correspond or can be described by different diagrams. Or to make this slightly more formal, here we are considering spin 1/2 in an SU2 representation. We can think of generalizing this to either a spin S or an SUN representation. And then one can show that the ladder diagrams are the leading contributions in a 1 over n expansion. And in the large n limit, we treat all diagrams exactly. So in that limit, we can describe non-magnetic states. On the other hand, the RPA diagrams are the leading contributions in a 1 over s expansion. And we treat them exactly in the large S limit. So in that limit, we can describe magnetically ordered state. And the neglected three-particle vertices, they are subleading both in 1 over N and in 1 over S. So that means, broadly speaking, order and disorder tendencies are equally included in this FRG scheme. Or in other words, when we are deep in a magnetically ordered phase, we can expect that that the method works because of this 1 over S property. If you are deep in a magnetically disordered phase, we can expect that it works because of this 1 over N property. What is, of course, more difficult is critical regions. In critical regions, these terms which we throw away, they might become important. So all we need to do is then solve the RG equations. This is done in real space, so it's a real space method. It's done with a full frequency dependence of vertex functions included. The system sizes that we can typically treat are rather large, so 2,000 sites is easily possible. Okay, that's...
What method are you using to solve the equations?
Sorry?
So what method are you using to solve the equations?
We have our own written code. Typically, just Euler's scheme for solving a differential equation is sufficient. So these are huge sets of coupled differential equations. So 10 million coupled differential equations. This is what it typically ends up at. But from the numerical side, I would say that it's still not too challenging. So numerically, it's rather well converged.
Is there a way how you could show convergently why there are so many equations? So maybe if you could show the approaching equations, how do they couple side to side of frequency?
Yeah, right. Okay, that's a good point. I should explain that. Okay, basically we calculate this object. This has first of all frequencies sitting at all legs. So for frequencies we have energy conservation, so we only have three frequencies. To get a finite set of equations, we need to discretize these continuous frequency dependencies. So we are using a finite mesh. And for each set of points, we have one equation. So this is already the number of frequencies to the power of 3. Then we have site dependencies sitting at the at the legs. So each leg is labeled with a lattice site. The good thing here is that along these lines, the lattice site doesn't change. In other words, the fermions do not hop. So this thing basically depends on two lattice sites because there are two lines going through. And for a system with translation invariance, it depends only on the distance. So here comes the real space dependence in. So for each distance, so for each correlator, we also have one equation. So you have to multiply the number of correlators in real space you want to calculate by the number of discrete frequency points you get, and then you easily get big numbers.
So discrete frequencies means imaginary time, or?
We are at imaginary frequencies, so in Matsubara space, but we are at t equals 0, so then they become continuous, but we in order to treat these equations, we have to artificially make them again.
Right, so that's what
we have to make them discrete again.
Are you really at a finite temperature then?
Well, we typically make it such that in the interesting flow regime where lambda is on the order of J, we try to make them very dense such that these effects do not arise. But at larger lambdas, we often have big intervals between frequencies. Well, that cannot be avoided.
And when do you stop the RG? At what value of lambda are you interested in the end?
In principle, we try to go down as far as possible, but due to numerical reasons, we often stop at 1% of J. Sometimes this is not sufficient. So in pyroglow systems, which we were recently studying, we have observed that we need to go down further to resolve some effects. But depends on the energy scale where one wants to resolve something. Okay, this was, how am I doing in time? It's okay. This was more the method-oriented part. Now I'm coming to applications. As a first application, and also for doing benchmark checks, we investigated the Kagome antiferromagnet with nearest neighbor interactions. This is already quite a very complex, an extremely complex system. It's rather settled now that it has a non-magnetic ground state, but I think the nature of this ground state is still still completely open. Okay, and here are our results on that system. So here I show the magnetic susceptibility from FRG in momentum space. And as a first observation, well, we see there are no sharp magnetic Bragg peaks in K-space, which gives us a first hint that that we are also detecting a non-magnetic system here. Here is shown the RG flow, so the susceptibility as a function of our RG parameter lambda for the maximum position, which is here. And likewise, the flow looks rather smooth and does not show any obvious signatures of an instability. I will show you on the next slide how an instability shows up. And this can also be compared with DMRG studies. So here I show a result from Depenbrock-Scholwick group, and it looks rather similar. Yeah, you get this response, which is mainly distributed around the extended Brillouin zone, and otherwise doesn't show any sharp peaks. So that makes us confident that that we are somehow simulating the right thing here. Okay, so this was about non-magnetic states. What about magnetic order? It's well known how to induce magnetic order in the Kagome anti-ferromagnet, namely by adding Chaloshinsky-Moria interactions. And if we switch on these couplings, then we see that a new peak appears, which becomes very sharp finally, and these are the peaks indicating this type of Q equals zero state. Yeah, it's well known that this type of state appears in this system if the M interaction is sufficiently large, and this is indicated by these peaks.
So what's the nature of this non-magnetic ground state? You just said that there is no peak, but can one analyze the nature of
Yes, this becomes difficult, but we have worked on that. So we tried to detect some dimerized pattern. First of all, see if there is some dimerization in the system. So basically, what we do in order to study possible dimerization is we slightly change the coupling strength on the bonds according to this dimerization pattern, and then see how the system reacts to that. The system never really reacts strongly to such dimer patterns. So we can conclude that it doesn't seem to dimerize. Then concerning really identifying the type of spin liquid, that's difficult. I will say in the end a few words about this in the outlook. Yeah, I will come back to that.
So this susceptibility, is that zero frequency or equal time?
Good question. This is zero frequency, so we calculate the static susceptibility. Yeah.
Can you do frequency dependence?
We can do frequency dependence, however, only on the Matsubara axis. So we have, so to say, the dynamics included, but in order to really resolve the excitation spectrum, we would have to do an analytical continuation, and that's not fun. We tried it, but it was never really controlled. We are planning as an extension to formulate the whole scheme on a Keldysh contour to avoid that. But that's basically work in progress. So for the moment, only static quantities can be calculated.
You may have just answered the question I had when you said about Keldysh. So in principle, because you're discretizing frequency anyway, what prevents you from formulating the entire mass of the real frequency?
Well, that basically applies to, or that boils down to doing Caldish.
Well, Caldish is if you want non-equilibrium response. I mean, I'm just saying at the level of when you write down the integral of the integration of internal frequencies.
Yeah.
Why not write down?
You mean okay, not Caldish, but just on the real axis.
Exactly.
I think but then. You know, you have to make sure that you're either slightly below or above the real axis. You just slightly bypass your poles, and I'm not sure if this is numerically controlled. So I think there you simply run into trouble because you have to take care of this slightly below or slightly above the frequency axis by some epsilon. That's exactly what.
If you in the case in which you find a non-magnetic ground state, let's say if the non-magnetic ground state was like a valence bond crystal, so broke symmetries like say translations or rotations, but not spin rotational symmetry.
Yeah.
Would you expect to see any breakdown in the in that case?
No, because so assume that the system spontaneously dimerizes. So then the order parameter consists of product of two spin operators. So the corresponding susceptibility would be a four particle vertex in my language. And that's simply not included. So unless we explicitly include that term, we will not see any non-analyticity as a result from dimerization. Yeah. So therefore, if we want to detect dimer order, we have to apply this trick which I just mentioned. Yeah. You give a small perturbation to the system and see how the system reacts to it. Okay, so let's stick for a moment here. So how can we actually see where the Q equals zero state sets in? So for that we need to look at the RG flow. This is the RG flow for varying dm interaction strength as a function of lambda for large dm vector, for example 1. Yeah, we get this typical instability signature. Yeah, this is a typical outcome of our approach. The flow, the susceptibility increases, and then suddenly it drops. So this is basically a regularized divergence. So if we were able to go to finite system sizes and to dense frequency mesh points, we would expect that this turns into a real divergence. We are limited in system size and frequencies. We can observe that it becomes stronger, but we can never really observe a real divergence.
What should we think about all the little wibbles for lambda?
Yeah, that's also artifacts of the frequency discretization. You can try to get rid of it if you make the frequencies denser and denser, but you will never really get completely rid of it.
But then how do you really distinguish the green when the D is zero?
Yeah, that's the difficulty. And that is indeed one of the key difficulties of this method, which is also reflected in this argument which I presented earlier. In critical regions, the method is probably tricky. Yeah, we see as we go down with D, this feature, it somehow smears out, which is somehow consistent with the fact that magnetic order gets smaller. But identifying where exactly the phase transition is, that's hard. We still tried it and tried to keep track of this feature by measuring the angle of that kink that is shown here, this angle as a function of D. And we see that something is happening here around 0.1, 0.11. Even though, of course, this is just now pure data analysis without not necessarily with real physics behind, but at least this seems to fit pretty well. So earlier ED studies also find roughly 10%. So it seems to fit roughly. So we seem to have the right balance between magnetic order and quantum fluctuations, if you wish, included in here.
And what is on the right hand side? So what is being plotted in the vertical axis?
This is basically the angle of that kink. So do we have? Can you see this?
There's a light switch near the board.
The
other
side. So chi lambda. So if we have something like this, then basically this angle here is measured. Yeah, this was actually averaged for different frequency mesh points to average out these wiggles. Again, it seems something is happening at this point.
The angle zero would mean what now is
the angle zero would mean the flow is simply smooth and doesn't show any instability.
So now, I see, because that's a function of t, I suppose.
Yeah.
But there's another thing between 0.15 and 0.2.
Between 0.15
in the right
other figure, right? I mean,
this here.
Yeah.
This is most likely the artifacts of a frequency of a discrete frequency disturbing the pattern.
So it becomes also very difficult to distinguish what is an artifact and what is
right. Here. Yeah. Yeah. So okay, don't take this too serious. I just want to show you how in principle it works and that there are difficulties arising, but still it seems that we are getting roughly the correct positions of phase boundaries out, even though I really don't want to pinpoint phase boundaries in many digits of a coupling ratio. This is not the purpose of our studies. So, okay, I would like to talk about something else, namely about an application to a real world material. How about time? Do I have time?
I think we're okay. We've had a number of questions already.
Okay.
But
yeah.
Sort of 10 minutes left.
Yeah. I think that should work. Yeah. This is quite an interesting spin liquid candidate system, which I'm studying together with my experimental colleagues in Helmholtz Center in Berlin. And Nick Shannon is also actively working on that. I will also say at least a few words about your very nice works on that. Okay, first of all, a few experimental facts about this material. So calcium chrome oxide consists of stacked spin 1/2 bilayer Kagome planes, where the spin 1/2s are coming from chromium 5 plus ions. The unit cell looks pretty complicated, but in the end it boils down to bilayer Kagome subsystems. Yeah, this is a Kagome bilayer subsystem, this here, and this here again. Now, maybe the most important experimental fact comes from muon spin relaxation measurements, which is an extremely sensitive probe with respect to detecting static magnetic order. And this approach rules out static magnetic order down to very low temperatures, which is seen from the absence of oscillations in these muon spin relaxation curves, which has also been confirmed in a magnetic field. Yeah, so we really seem to have an interesting non-magnetic ground state in the system. This is also supported by inelastic neutron scattering. Shown here is the spin structure factor as a function of energy, and some momentum space direction, it's all rather smooth and smeared out, so no clear signatures of a magnetic spin wave. Also here, for a slice at a particular energy, now in momentum space, it also looks rather broad and smeared out. So what you would expect from a spinon continuum. Yeah, you know, you can never measure a single spinon. You only can measure the two spinon continuum in neutron scattering, which is expected to be somehow broad and smeared out. You can ignore these strong red features here. They are just phonons. A characteristic pattern, though, are these rings in momentum space. Here is a ring, and here is another one. I will come back to them.
Do you happen to know how strong is the inter-ray coupling?
I will come to that.
But is it stronger or weaker than the inter-ray?
It's weaker, but I will discuss. Yeah, give me. Yeah.
Does the continuous spectrum always indicate there is a spinor excitation?
No, of course not. But this is a question which is of course debated a lot. So we know a spin liquid. Spinons in a spin liquid would typically show something broad and diffuse, but the argument doesn't go the other way around. So of course, yeah, for example, disorder effects, what we discussed last week, disorder effects could easily mimic something broad, which at the first glance looks like a spin liquid. Here we are somehow on the lucky side, because there doesn't seem to be much inter-side mixing, because all the ions involved have very distinct radii.
Do you specifically need a polar system?
Yeah, I will come. Okay. I will show. Yeah.
So this system doesn't order, right?
The system doesn't order.
Then how do you do a spin wave theory? Some order.
I think you should let him go.
Yeah. You're asking all types of questions which I will answer. Okay, so what are the exchange couplings? That is, of course, the important question. Also, this is a quite long story, but I would like to make it short here. So spin waves have been measured by neutron scattering in a magnetic field. So the magnetic field has been tuned to a value where the system is almost polarized, and then we observed spin waves, and you could fit them to spin wave theory. And the best fit gave the exchange couplings. And the result is the following. Each Kagome layer consists of ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic nearest neighbor couplings. So if we just consider one layer, then for example, the up triangles carry the ferromagnetic couplings and the down triangles the anti-ferromagnetic ones. Here are the numbers in both layers, where one can see that both layers are different. So there is an asymmetry between both layers. And quite interestingly, and that's an important fact, the ferromagnetic interaction is always considerably larger than the anti-ferromagnetic interaction. Now, that alone wouldn't be too exciting, because you would always expect that the three ferromagnetically coupled spins, that they combine into a large spin 3/2, and on a triangular lattice, they would always combine into 120 degree nail order. So where does the frustration come from? Well, we have two more important pieces of information here. First of all, the ferromagnetic triangles in one layer lie on top of the anti-ferromagnetic triangles in the other layer, and they are now connected by a ferromagnetic inter-layer coupling. These are the black lines. And that now really frustrates the system, because that makes sure that neither the top nor the bottom layer can arrange in the preferred 120 degree nail order. So this is basically, again, the motive of frustration. We have a ferromagnetic triangle on top of an anti-ferromagnetic one, and they are ferromagnetically coupled, and that's that cannot all be simultaneously satisfied. So first of all, from a theorist's perspective, this is like almost like a nightmare. You have this complicated geometry, you have these five different couplings, but still there are a few previous theory works. There is first of all our initial experiment plus theory paper where we did FRG. I will show you that in a moment. Then, as mentioned, Nick is also working on that, doing MD simulations and quite an interesting spin 3/2 honeycomb mapping. Yeah, this is basically motivated by the fact that you do have these strong ferromagnetic triangles. So you can think that you get an effective spin 3/2 there. So you can contract the ferromagnetic triangles to a point, then you get an effective honeycomb model. I will also say a few words about this in a moment. Then Kader Damli also has a nice work on this, which also partially relies on this honeycomb mapping. And quite interestingly, very recently, in the group of Jens Eisert, tensor network approaches were applied to treat the system, and they could also confirm that it's non-magnetic. So this is actually quite remarkable. Okay, but what about our results? Yeah, so also for us, it's a complicated system, but we also have a flexible code, and we could more or less just plug in the interactions. And this is our result as compared to neutron scattering. We see that we resolve these rings, as shown here and here. But you also see that the agreement is clearly not perfect. For example, we are missing response at these points here. We have ideas how that can be fixed, but this is basically still open. But the most important features, we would say, are there. And we also get an idea where these rings come from. Imagine we wouldn't have this coupling, this frustrating ferromagnetic coupling between the layers. Then the system would order in the 120 degree Néel state, which manifests in peaks here. And if we then switch on this coupling, the system becomes frustrated, the magnetic order disappears, the peaks become broadened. They become broadened so much that they form these rings. And we also calculated the susceptibility during the RG flow. This is basically free of any instability signatures. So we can also confirm that the ground state seems to be non-magnetic. Interestingly, also this result agrees at least approximately with the measured data, without any fitting involved. So this was quite of a positive surprise to us. Maybe a few words more about the origin of these rings here. As I mentioned before, you can do this effective honeycomb mapping where the system reduces to a honeycomb system with ferromagnetic J1 and anti-ferromagnetic J2, including error bars. We are roughly in that regime. Because we have spin 3/2, a classical treatment is justified. So the classical phase diagram in the space of J1, J2, J3 is this here, taken from this paper. Our compound lies somewhere here on this axis, and quite close by there is this line here, and this line separates two extended phases, but the line is has degenerate classical states. It's a spiral spin liquid, so you have degenerate spiral states which form rings in momentum space. These rings actually of this spiral spin liquid nearby can explain a lot. For that I refer you to Nick's very nice paper. Okay, something else we did is exploring how stable this non-magnetic phase actually is. So we varied the exchange couplings of the system, and we actually resolved quite a remarkable stability. So here we scaled the anti-ferromagnetic intralayer couplings by a factor of 1/2. So we drive the system more towards the spiral spin liquid. We can also see that, so the weight gets more evenly distributed along the ring, but most importantly, the system is still non-magnetic. You can infer this from the RG flow. This was the original set of parameters. Here we did something opposite. We rescaled the ferromagnetic intralayer couplings by a factor of 1/2. So this makes the honeycomb mapping essentially less valid. This is still non-magnetic, but seems to be the edge of the non-magnetic phase. However, one very important fact also, if we make the couplings the same in both layers, we make the system symmetric with respect to both layers by, let's say, taking the average values of the couplings in both layers, we get a tiny little feature of maybe something. This might indicate that the system shows weak magnetic order. So the fact that we have an asymmetry seems to be important. So to my understanding, what makes this spin liquid so stable is that there is a hierarchy of, we don't know if it's a spin liquid, but at least a non-magnetic state. What makes this state so stable is that you have a hierarchy of different frustration and fluctuation effects. Even if your ferromagnetic couplings are infinitely large, you still get a fully frustrated system. If you make them finite, you add a source of fluctuation to the system. If you now additionally make both layers asymmetric, then this adds another source of frustration to the system, which seems to be important. Okay, I will just briefly flash some slides concerning extensions and outlook. Of course, a relevant question is, what is the nature of the spin liquid of this compound, if it's indeed a spin liquid? It's quite interesting that indeed the heat capacity of the system, and that relates to your earlier question, the heat capacity below 0.5 Kelvin is almost perfectly linear. So for that reason, it really seems tempting to propose a Spinon Fermi surface here. This is an experimental result. Yeah, this is experimental. And indeed, we did a careful analysis of the data, also including neutron scattering data, and we came up with a possible spinon band structure that could explain the measured data. I will not go into detail here, but refer to this paper here. We basically have a low energy and a high energy spinon band and a spinon Fermi surface.
How do you determine this from FRG?
No, this is independent of FRG here. However, we are also working on an approach to directly calculate spinon bands from FRG. That's work in progress. We have a first paper out on that. But I think in order to tell you details about that, we should do it in private discussions. Otherwise, we are really running out of time. Yeah. Sorry for the delay, but I'm coming to an end. 3D systems is something we recently started doing. It's possible in higher dimensions. Even the method becomes better because we still have this kind of mean field background of the approach. So, for example, we could observe the evolution of the pinch points when we go from S equals infinity to S equals 1/2. But also here, I refer you to our paper. higher loop FRG, including more diagrams, including parts of the three particle vertex. That's another direction of research which we recently started, and what would also be interesting, Majorana FRG, not based on complex fermions, but on Majorana fermions, which might give an easier description of Kitaev models or perturbations thereof. Okay, conclusion. I hope I can convince you that that this is an interesting method which allows one to investigate large classes of spin systems with many different types of interactions, longer range couplings as well, two dimensions, three dimensions, large system sizes, and I haven't talked about this much, but larger spins are also possible. What doesn't work? Couplings beyond two-body interactions cannot be treated. Biquadratic interactions, no chance. We would have to include the four-particle vertex, which is basically out of reach. No dynamic response functions yet. I've talked about that. 1D systems, very bad. We have this mean field background still, and mean field is doing very bad in 1D. Critical regions, also very hard to explore. I would like to thank my collaborators. This is my theory group from Berlin, my external theory collaborators, and the experimentalists, mainly the group of Bella Lake from Berlin. And finally, let me thank you for your attention.
Some of the technical aspects of your approach. I know they had quite a lot of questions, but maybe just one or two.
Actually, for your FRG, is it possible to calculate the static spin correlator at finite momentum? Because if you really have a spin on Fermi surface, one expects there should be some 2k of singularity.
Okay, because of the scattering between two points of the spin on Fermi surface. Okay, that I've actually never thought about. Well, I'm not sure if I can answer this question in real time. We might have to go to an effective gauge theory picture again. I'm not sure. It might be complicated.
I think maybe we have quite a lot of questions. We should have one from somebody else.
Thank you. So I was wondering for this Fermi surface, the spin on Fermi surface, how do you get it? Or has this been looked at from density functional theory? I saw Harald Dieschke's name on some slide.
First of all, Harald Dieschke's part is DFT, so for some materials we take his input from DFT to have the chase. But what was the first part of your...
Whether this was the result, or how do you come up...
This year. Basically, by making educated guesses based on the experimental data we have, we constructed a family of models. It's hard to pinpoint one model, but a family of models which reproduce the experimental data, basically, and a characteristic band structure looks like this here. So it's not a systematic method behind that. So it's not related to FRG.
So I think maybe we should go to lunch now and save all of our other questions. So thank you again.